This is a bill we passed last year and was on the general register at the end of session. The motion is House File 655 be placed on the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
And Representative Rundeck, we have minutes. Members, in your packet, we have minutes from January 23rd, 2013.
There's
a correction.
Small typo correction.
Small typo correction. Representative Dorholt, you want to make a motion on the February 23rd minutes?
Move to pass the minutes of February 23rd.
As corrected?
January.
January 23rd.
I'm sorry.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. We have the minutes, again, a correction, slight correction from the minutes from February 20th of 2013. Representative Dorholt, looked at the minutes. You want to make the motion?
So moved. To pass the minutes as amended.
All in favor of passing the minutes from the 20th. February 20th, 2013, as corrected, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's passed. We also have the minutes for May 13th, 2013. And these have not been seen. These are from our last meeting. Representative Dorholt.
I move to pass the minutes of May 13th.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. The minutes are approved. And September 18th meeting that we had in the state office building having to do with rulemaking. Representative Dorholt.
Mr. Chair, move to pass the minutes of September 18th.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. And from our meeting that we had up in St. Cloud, Representative Dorholt.
Mr. Chair, move to approve the minutes of October 15th, 2013.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Motion passes. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if you could introduce our new staff, at least the pages, and it looks like there might be a new researcher as well. Or no?
Molly Richardson is, want to give you a little bit of a description. She's our new house researcher, DFL house researcher.
Sorry, I'll say it again. Been practicing law in New Jersey for the last 5 years and now moving back to Minnesota.
You represent the votes?
No.
Representative Pepin.
Oh, I was just gonna, if you could introduce the pages too.
I don't, what? Over there. Instead of give your name, I haven't been introduced to you myself.
Hi, my name is Michael Rosenow. I'm getting my master's degree from Northwestern University in Chicago in public administration and public policy.
Thank you.
I can get you Cokes and stuff, so let me know.
And do I see Representative Rundeck here yet? Do we need to have her here?
I texted him, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we just, there's a slight amendment I saw.
Yes, it's changing the date.
And so I'll make the motion first, the House file 155 be placed on the general register, and I'll move the amendment that should be in your packets, the A5 amendment, members. And again, this is a bill that we passed last year, and the amendment basically just changes the date, the effective date from 2013 to 2014. But otherwise, we passed this last year and sent it to the general register. Are there any questions, members? If not, I'll move the A5 amendment. All in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment passes. Or the amendment's adopted. Back to the bill. House file 155. I move that House file 155 be placed on the general register. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Bill is moved to the general register. Now, the next on our agenda is House File 2029. Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, do you want to make the motion?
Yes, I'd like to move that House File 2029 be moved to pass. And where does it go? To
the State Gov Finance.
State Gov Finance. Goes to State Gov Finance.
With the new memo that we got, it has to just be referred. We don't pass it; just gets referred to State Gov Finance.
Yes, that's right. Sorry.
That's okay. That's we're all new.
I can't.
Yes, we're all new at this. Yeah. It's
Okay. House File 2029, it actually came to me from the Council on Black Minnesotans, but it was something that I started worrying about as soon as I started paying serious attention to the legacy bill, particularly in the arts area, although it might occur for other parts of the legacy bill. And that's the fact that it really looked as if we weren't paying sufficient advice. I don't want to say disadvantaged communities, but I want to say communities that are not part of the Minnesota establishment, the established art community and so forth. And I think there are problems, and maybe these can be addressed in state government finance when we get to it. One of the things that problems with some of the rules that, for example, the State Arts Board has, you can't apply for a grant from the State Arts Board unless you've been in existence in, you know, rigid existence, whatever that means, incorporated or listed or something for 2 years. And so I think I understand that that means that they don't want to get into a lot of new groups that may not pay out, but it clearly puts groups that are not like the Minnesota Orchestra or the St. Paul Chamber or the Arts Institute at a disadvantage. And so we want them to tell us how they're going to figure out how to deal with that. And I'd like to turn to the people who obviously know very much more about the problem and very much more about it than I do, and I'd like to let them introduce themselves.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the tape, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Yeah. My name is Janata Petras.
Okay.
Chairman Nelson and other esteemed representatives of... Okay, cool. Thank you. Chairman Nelson and other esteemed representatives of the House Committee on Government Operation. My name is Janata Petras, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to you today about the Council on Black Minnesotans legislative proposal relating to black arts in the state of Minnesota. I will keep my comments brief, and I will be happy to respond to any questions. I first became acquainted with the work of the Council on Black Minnesotans through my work with the Minnesota Humanities Center in 2012. I was impressed with the tremendous vision and enthusiasm the Council had in regards to the lives and experience, not only of Minnesotans of African descent, but of all Minnesotans. In my capacity at the Minnesota Humanities Center, I gained an appreciation for the Council's commitment to the lives of Minnesotans of African descent. This past fall, I was fortunate to get the opportunity to work with the Council on Black Minnesotans and build with an organization that has a powerful legacy and promising future in serving the needs of black Minnesotans and ultimately all Minnesotans. The African Heritage Arts and Cultural Preservation and Growth Bill is from the community. The Council asked me to seek out artists in the state, listen to them, to learn from them, and through this to understand the community's needs and visions. The desire of the Council was to get wisdom and feedback from the community in order to create the legislation before you. From these conversations with artists, it became clear that the impact and legacy of black arts in the state is large, deep, and continuously unfolding. That within the artists is a key to archiving stories, reflecting on modern realities, celebrating beauty and individuality and positive transformation. That it is critical to the future of arts in the state to include all communities in our work moving forward. This opportunity was tremendously important, and the feedback we got from the community was insightful, critical, and heartfelt. It was amazing to learn about all of the different artists in various mediums and stages in their career. I saw incredible diversity within the group of black artists that the state has to offer. We have sat down with hip-hop MCs, storytellers, actors, dancers, singers, musicians, and poets who represent a variety of ethnic backgrounds and who are passionate about not only creating, but making contributions within the community. So whether it be in theaters, galleries, parks, or schools. In this work, we also became aware that we had only scratched the surface to the vastness of this community. Personally, I have appreciated my experiences as an artist in the state, my home state. Creating art for me is a calling, and I have committed myself to being an artist in the service of my state, my community, in the honor of my ancestors, and am committed to illuminating and amplifying black truth and reality in my work. I'm a writer, a playwright, an aerialist, and dancer. I'm also an educator and a community worker. I have within my community, who you see among us, tremendous artists who have given me guidance, love, and support in pursuing my craft and my mission. I have also been inspired by these artists to be a better person and strive for change and transformation in my life and the world. I believe in the power of art to make tangible change that can be felt, seen, and touched. Therefore, I humbly urge you to vote in favor of HF 2029 and recommend its approval to the full House. Thank you for your support of this important issue, and thank you for your commitment to equal access and opportunities for all in the great state of Minnesota. And I would also like to introduce my colleague, Satu Jones, to give some remarks as well.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jones. Could you please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony?
My name is Satu Ken Jones. Thank you, Mr. Chair, distinguished representatives. I first have to apologize. On your agenda, you'll see the name Reggie Prim. And I have to ask you for your forgiveness. I keep turning around waiting for Reggie to come in. He's stuck on a bus right now on his way here. And I hope that my comments won't match his eloquence. But I want to first give you some background and then talk about why we need to support this bill. I am a fourth generation Minnesotan. I was born in North Minneapolis and raised in South Minneapolis, graduate of Washburn High School, and graduate of the University of Minnesota, and went on for a graduate degree from there as well. I have created over 30 large-scale public artworks throughout the U.S. and live and work in a studio space less than a mile and a half from here in Frogtown, in an old storefront that my wife and I renovated. That is my laboratory where I create this work. I have been really fortunate and blessed to have been making art for the last 40 years and really blessed to have made a living from that work in different ways. Now, my work, as I said, I create large-scale public artwork, so my income is primarily from commissions. And, in fact, I was one of seven artists chosen from an artist pool across the country to create or integrate artworks into the Green Line stations. And so I'm working right now, if it ever warms up, to make my final pieces or insert my final pieces into the Capitol stop right out here. And so while I have been fortunate and blessed, part of the reason I wanted to give you this background is to tell you that I am an exception. I'm not exceptional. There are so many folks who are my peers, who haven't been as successful as I have been. And I use that term with some reluctance, because many people have told me over and over that I have I am one of the most noted visual artists in Minnesota and one of the more successful artists in visual artists in Minnesota. And if that's the case, then we are really in trouble as a society. Because based on my meager income, one of the points I really want to make is that even with my success, there have been opportunities that have been denied me. I just was at a point, even with the 30 commissions that I've done across the country, as Representative Kahn pointed out, many of the hoops and obstacles that we as artists generally have to overcome are these eligibility requirements. One of those requirements, and the State Arts Board requires this for artists that create these public artworks, is that you have to have at least 3 public service commissions, sometimes 4, or public sector commissions, sometimes 4, before you're even eligible to apply. That's one of those many obstacles that we face. And the grim reality is that many artists, and African American artists in particular, don't have the organizational infrastructure to support our work. When I said I'm an exception, there are so many, I should back up a little bit, from being a part of this community and part of the artistic community for the last 35 years, you know, I've had a few doors open to me. So I've been able to see inside many of the cultural institutions that Representative Kahn pointed out. In particular, the large-scale visual arts organizations, the Walker Arts Center, Minneapolis Institute of Arts, the Wiseman Art Museum, the Minnesota Museum of American Art. And as those doors have opened, I've been able to see who is employed in those cultural institutions that employ hundreds of folks. And just based on casual observation, I can see that there aren't that many people of color in the positions outside of security and food service or maintenance. And we haven't had a Jackie Robinson yet in the art world. It's unfortunately one of the last bastions of white supremacy that goes unquestioned in our society. And hopefully this bill will open up those doors wider so that we know how many people are working in those institutions. But what we don't know are their demographics. And this bill would allow us to open up those doors wide enough to gain an accurate count of all of those folks who are there. Now, when I was describing my studio as well, too, I'm just going to show one more instance of this disparity. And as I said, I know this community relatively well and know the condition and plight in many cases of many African American artists. I live and work in a studio space a mile and a half from here that my wife and I renovated now almost 20 years ago. So it's an old storefront. We live upstairs and have studio space downstairs. I, unfortunately, am one of only 5 African American artists that I know of that own their own studio space. So I live and work there. This gets back to the issues and the disparity in housing that we face among us. And so I encourage you to support this bill so that we can really begin this long-term count to look at these areas that we really need to improve. I support and recommend the approval of House File number 2029. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And I think we all also hope that it warms up so that you can finish your work. Maybe next week, but probably before July. Any questions of the testifiers? Representative Pepin?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, actually just some questions for Representative Kahn.
Okay.
That would be okay. Representative Kahn, I realize this isn't state government, but I'm just trying to figure out, since this will have an impact on the Arts Board, do you have any idea of how much something like this would cost? I'm not really clear if it's, is it, would you have to, would they have to hire another staff person, or do you have any sort of idea on that?
Representative Kahn.
I don't think so. I would hope they could do it with existing staff, because the existing staff are the people who know how the decisions are made. They need to bring people in to testify. You know, it's like people testifying before the legislature. We often do that without paying people to do that. I think they can probably give us a better, knowing the kinds of things that, you know, in the past, the kinds of things, I would think a minimum of maybe about $10,000 and then going up to maybe 50 or something like that. But that's just a guess. We'd have to get some examples, some ideas from them. And one of the things that happens, why I'm not asking for an appropriation to go with this, is that we've consistently throughout the history had projects that they end up doing some supplementary funding at the end, because projects that they funded for some reason use less or can't be done and so forth.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Representative Kahn, I'm just kind of curious, why couldn't the Council on Black Minnesotans pay for this, and why what would prevent them from the budget coming from them instead?
Well,
Representative Kahn.
I guess I should let maybe the member. My thought would be is that the problem doesn't reside with them. The problem resides with the people that are making the decisions, that they a decision tree that they can't get into. So that's my issue.
Representative Pepin.
Okay, maybe just one more question for Representative Kahn, and then I'm wondering if the Arts Board could maybe just come down, and I'm curious if they support it and
okay.
How they'd pay for it. Representative Kahn, I just have a couple questions about the actual report itself. It says that the report should go to the legislature and then the arts community, and I'm wondering exactly who that would be. Would that be the leads of, and if so, which committees, or does it go to all the legislature? And then I'm not really clear who the arts community is, and how would that information be distributed, and to whom?
Well, I do believe that reports go to the chief clerk in the legislature. I think that we have a standard way that reports get distributed. So I think so. You know, so the answer is, other than that, I don't know. The arts community, I would think that we would just have a public notice saying that the report has been released. I don't think that there are specific people that are listed in that.
Mr. Shepherd, can you, is there a standard way that they're normally done for reports? Could maybe answer that question.
Mr. Chair and members, in general, there's a statute that says that a report to the legislature required of an agency, unless otherwise specifically provided by law, is made by filing two copies with the reference library and then making it electronically available to the reference library. So that's how a report to the legislature is filed. But this bill would also require it to go to the governor and the legacy committee and the arts community. So that would be filed with the reference library and with these other entities.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. So the arts community, is that, it's not defined anywhere? Okay. I think that's problematic. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Ms. Jens maybe could come and testify. I'm curious if they support it and if they're able to pay for it and that type of thing out of their current.
Yeah. Ms. Jens, you want to come down? And while you're doing that, Representative Roskowski had a question. Representative Roskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the last testifier. I didn't catch his name, but
Say to Jones.
Mr. Jones. Thank you, Mr. Jones. You made one statement that I wrote down here because it was quite striking. You said that I think you were referring to the arts community as one of the last bastions of white supremacy that exists, and I was kind of taken aback by that. And can you expound on what that means? And is there discrimination against black people in the arts community, or what?
What I'm actually referring to,
Mr. Jones,
is I'm sorry.
It's okay.
What I'm actually referring to is the exclusion of people of color and African Americans in particular from positions of power and responsibility within those institutions, within the cultural institutions that I named even. And we really don't have to look around, you know, in too much depth, and just based on casual observations, just to see the absence of people of color, and sometimes in programming as well, too.
Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Jones, the absence of people of color at certain positions then equates into white supremacy?
Well, it's not just Mr. the Jones. Absence. I'm sorry.
Mr. Jones.
I'm sorry. It's not just the absence, but it's also the lack of power. You know, one of the things that I do many times when I have opportunities like this in public forums is to talk about love. And Martin Luther King expounded on love often, but he always equated love and power, and said that power is not power is nothing bad. But he said that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. And what I'm equating that to is the lack of power, the lack of the ability to make those changes. I mean, I could talk about racism as well too, and even substitute racism with that. You know, I don't want to offend folks when I say or when I use the term white supremacy, but that's actually what it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Jones, I'll continue to ponder that. I appreciate it.
Ms. Jens, you want to come down and testify, and then Hanson. And Ms. Jens, I believe Representative Pepin, you want to restate your question to Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Ms. Jens, thanks for coming. I'm just curious if you support this, or if the board supports this, if you've got the current staff, the ability to do this, and then also, since we're just picking out one group here, what if other cultural groups would come forward? What kind of, if the Latinos wanted to do it, or the Polish Americans or something wanted to do a study? I don't know that that'll happen. Maybe the Latinos, probably not some of the others, but what kind of impact would that have?
Ms. Jens, please state your name for the tape, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. Thank you, Representative Pepin, for the questions, and Representative Kahn for bringing the bill forward. I can't say that the Arts Board supports this, only because I first heard about this bill yesterday at about 5 o'clock. So we've not considered it. We've not spent time thinking about it. This issue was not brought to us before it came to you as a bill. So I'm looking at it now for the first time and having some reactions to it. So let me say this. The Arts Board is absolutely concerned about the extent to which the funds that we receive and the regional arts councils receive are reaching and serving all Minnesotans. We absolutely are concerned about that. If there are issues or problems that communities are facing in particular, we certainly want to have those conversations with them. We do monitor the racial and ethnic characteristics of grantees that come to the Arts Board. We don't often publish a lot of those statistics because some of that is related to data privacy, but we do try to collect that. It is voluntary. It is not required, so we have some of that. We know we can do more and better with that. There are a couple of things that were said here today that I wanted to respond to, just because there are some things that have been raised, and I wanted to be clear about that. One was the requirement that an organization must have been in existence for 2 years to come to the Arts Board. That is absolutely true in one of our grant programs. We have other project grant programs where that isn't the case. And we also have 11 regional arts councils in the state of Minnesota that may or may not have that similar requirement. So what we're trying to do is to think about the system as a whole. And we do have a program that is meant to fund organizations that are well established and have been in business for 2 years or longer. So that was true. Mr. Jones mentioned the commissions he has done. Some of those were funded through the state of Minnesota's Percent for Art program, which we manage. The Green Line is not a state of Minnesota project, and the Arts Board doesn't manage it. So the condition that he stated about requiring 3 or 4 public commissions for eligibility isn't an Arts Board rule and doesn't exist in the Percent for Art program. That was a rule for that particular commissioning project, which I think is in Metropolitan Council. Okay. All right. In the state's Percent for Art program, I'm very familiar with this because we've just hired someone new who is looking at all of our rules and contracts. We don't have a requirement for the number of commissions someone will have had. So I think part of what could be helpful is to have a conversation about what the problems are and see if some of it is perception. See if some of it is really things that we can work with the council and with the arts community to address. As far as whether we would have sufficient staff or sufficient expertise to do the study, I think it would depend on what the expectations of the study are. What are the outcomes? What are the expected outcomes? What level of expertise? One jumped out at me that doing an economic impact study, that's not really our area of expertise, but maybe the Department of Employment and Economic Development could play a role in that. So I do think that understanding how we can better use our public dollars to serve all Minnesotans is something we care deeply about and would like to work with Representative Kahn and the council to see how that might happen.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my voice is a little tattered, but and Representative Kahn, I'm kind of following up on Representative Pepin's question about definition on who the report should go to. And after hearing Ms. Jen's testimony, maybe to make this clearer, is you'd say that the report should go to the Arts Board, Regional Arts Councils, the legislature. And then instead of just the arts community, maybe it's the, I'm just thinking of all the publicly funded arts entities that we provide, whether it's the Guthrie or whether it's the Minnesota Orchestra or whether it's, I mean, you could have, elsewhere we provide provisions for saying that the Arts Board or any other entity should put it on their website. We want to make sure that the results of what the study comes out with are available to those granting entities and to the state-funded entities. So I think there's some words maybe Mr. Shepard could define this to make it clearer, because I don't think sending the report out to the arts community is, it's a lot of paper that we would be sending out to. We could define it to get to those state-funded entities, have it put on the websites, the regional arts councils, and make sure that folks are aware of it when it's completed. If that was drafted, I would move it. If could, you know, if this is, Mr. Chair, is this going to leave here today, or is this?
Representative Hansen, this bill is going to, because there's a fiscal impact, it's going to state government finance. So that would kind of in the purview that they could handle that minor change if it gets drafted before it gets there.
Mr. Chair, if it takes time for proper wordsmithing, I would have the commitment from the author that she would make that clearer and tighter along with the testimony that we've had today, I would be willing to let it go as long as it happens in that next committee.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, I think that's an excellent idea. I'm sorry. I can't believe how fast this session started. And I apologize to Ms. Jens, too, for the very late notice, and we're seeing a bill all around and we don't realize that it doesn't go out to the public until you know the legislature comes into being. So certainly I think that's a very excellent idea to get rid of the not clear words and to specifically send it to the Regional Arts Board and the State, well, the State Arts Board will be doing it, and have some language about distribution to the responsibility for distribution to the arts community or information to the arts community. I think we're all learning how fast information gets around these days. And
any further questions? Any further questions? If not, Representative Kahn, do you want to renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew this motion that this bill
be
moves
referred.
On to
be referred
state
to.
Government finance.
Everybody, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The bill the motion passes. The bill's referred.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda, we have Representative Breinert. And while she's getting ready, I'll move the House File 1455 be recommended to be sent to the General Register. Representative Breinert, welcome to our committee, and please give us a description of your bill, House 1455.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Well, this bill is much less compelling than the last testimony you heard, but nevertheless important for my district. So, House File 1455 proposes special law providing for the Blue Earth County Board of Commissioners to be the authority over the county library system, except for designated policy areas. This special law reflects the reality of current board operations and is supported by both the County Board of Commissioners and the Library Board. While General Law, Chapter 134, provides for libraries to have authority over their own operations, there is precedent for this change, such as 1981 legislation governing Hennepin County's library and 2005 legislation governing Washington County. We have with us today Tim Hayes, Director of the Blue Earth County Library System, to make a brief comment on the bill and answer any questions you might have.
Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim Hayes, and I am the director of the Blue Earth County Library down in Mankato, Minnesota. Just want to reiterate what Representative Breinert said, that it is just to formalize current library board practice and procedures, and the county board and library board are both in agreement with this action.
Thank
and
you,
open
sir.
Up to any questions.
Any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either to Representative Breinert or to the testifier, is there smaller entities that are out there that this will help pull them together and put them under one management? I guess I'm not seeing, if we already have the library board, why we would want to have the county have umbrella jurisdiction. I'm just kind of missing, in my mind there's just kind of a disconnect. So if you can just help me fill in those blanks, I think I'll get a better idea.
Representative Breinert.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I'll do my best to reply. Current Minnesota statute puts libraries in complete control of their own operations. And this is asking for special law to actually reflect what's currently going on. The county board indeed is operationally in charge of the library, and the library board does not want complete control over their own operations. So they're actually already operating as an advisory board and have been doing so for a length of time. So they're seeking to formalize the actual process by which they operate. So, you know, if this statute didn't move forward, they would simply continue operating in a format different than state statute allows them to operate. So it's trying to clarify and give statutory, you know, position to their current structure.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And this is just more of a comment than it is a follow-up question. In the era of the unsession this year, maybe this is something that more than just Blue Earth and Washington and Hennepin County would like to take advantage of, and maybe we look at globally what the processes are so they can take care of this at a more subsidiary level than having to come to the legislature, if it makes sense in the local jurisdiction. So,
Representative O'Driscoll, that's sort of like the letting counties and change from elected to appointed positions, that we always have that. We get a lot of those every year, and looking at it globally as opposed to individually, some people are willing to go individually but not globally.
Mr. Chair, intimately familiar with that bill yesterday.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. I think you're going to see more coming. I know my county has a question, and it relates to, is Blue Earth County a county manager system? I know there's some different types, so do you have other advisory boards that are going to be independent, or I know what my county is asking is for a change in their designation of how they're structured, how they're administered, whether it's a county manager, so that all advisory commissions would be clearly under the county board versus being separate. So my question to you is that a similar situation in your county, or did that come up, or do you have other advisory boards that are because of the way you're structured?
Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do have a number of advisory boards in Blue Earth County. This is, in fact, the way we are doing it with most of them. They are appointed by the county board. They come under that supervision. So it would not be outside the practice that we currently have. The library itself would be a department within the county, just as human services, environmental, those types of departments. So we would have the same standing as any other department within the county.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Shepard or Ms. Dyson, the structure of how counties are managed, how they're set up, and it doesn't have to be right now, but I think it might be something to do a little research in terms of how counties are structured relating to what they can do and can't do without their boards, because some have greater autonomy. If we could get something back to the committee, because this would follow up on what Representative O'Driscoll is doing, I think we're going to see more counties coming forward on this, and how we relate to them in terms of a definition may help dealing on a broader scale. And if this works for you, other counties are could come forward and say, well, we want to do the same thing.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Brainerd, I'm somewhat confused about your comment that this is kind of a formality of what has already been going on. So would that mean then that currently before this law, that if, say, the library board were sued, then the county board would automatically sue? They're the legal authority over them now? I'm not sure how. I'm unclear on your statement.
Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I might ask for some legal opinion on that. I can't respond to, in practice, Blue Earth County does take that responsibility. Whether that could be challenged in terms of, could the board be sued independently? Well, they have no resources independently of the county, because the county does fund them, you know, through county property taxes and, you know, county resources. So I would think any lawsuit, if it expected to have any resources available to it, would go to the county and not through the library board, because that is the way the board is functioning currently. Statute allows it to, current Minnesota law allows boards to function differently, but that's not the way the board has been functioning in Blue Earth County for a number of years. I maybe would legal counsel like to speak to that? I don't know who would.
I'm getting shakes right of the head. No. Representative Pepin, follow up.
Thank you. That's fine. I was just going to make a general comment. I think the wording of it is a little confusing, because the first sentence says, the Blue Earth County Board shall be the authority over all aspects of the Blue Earth County Library System. I guess it is clarified in the second part, I was going to say, but then lower you had listed separately, but I guess it is more clear in the second part. Except those authorized and responsible section. Okay, never mind in the second part.
Any further questions? Druskowski, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Ms. Dyson, or maybe Representative Brainerd, too. So as I understand this, at one point in time, Blue Earth County commissioners created a library board according to law. Is that how it worked? And the operations of the library board have been more subservient to the county board in the way they've kind of operated. Wouldn't another solution be, rather than creating more statute and more government here, to be to rescind the original motion by the county board to create the library board in the first place and allow an informal operating organization to do these tasks?
Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, by statute, the county is required to establish a library board. So by statute, you'd have to literally change the statute itself, and that would be going all the way back. So they were basically just following, you know, Minnesota law. What we are asking for is just an exemption of that statute, saying the board, the library board itself, will still exist as in an advisory capacity rather than a governing board. And that's the whole point of the request for this legislation at this time.
Representative Skousky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So every county in Minnesota is required, according to statute, to establish a library board according to law. Is that what I heard?
Mr. Hayes.
Mr. Chair. Yes. By statute, counties are mandated to establish libraries within their county boundaries. So,
Representative Skousky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is every county required to establish a library board?
Mr. Hayes.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hayes.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew the motion that House File 1455 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr.
Referred.
Chair, members.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Next we have Representative Carlson, 2093. Welcome to our committee, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman.
And I understand you have two amendments here. I'll move.
What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if it would be all right with you, is to explain the bill. And the amendments are not necessarily mine, although I would like to adopt part of one of the amendments and maybe have the longer amendment at that point in time divided. For further discussion, I just received, I first saw the amendments on Monday. They came in late Thursday or Friday from the Minsky system, and I was in L.A. at that point. And by the way, on Monday, enjoyed shirt-sleeve weather at the Grove, the farmer's market, having lunch outside, and a few hours later, I'm
Representative Carlson. If you
I'm
want
here.
Your bill passed, I don't think you want to rub that in our nose. I'll move House File.
What I'm referring to is the shock when I got back.
I'll move House File 2093 to be referred to Ways and Means, and proceed with your explanation.
Mr. Chairman, a lot of members may not necessarily be aware of one of the roles that the Chair of Ways and Means has, but I'm asked to provide advisory recommendations before state agencies or the higher ed systems enter into land purchases, land exchanges, or do major construction. And the way that works internally, then I ask staff to review the purchase of that property, the history of it, and what the appraised value and the assessed value have been. And most of the time, that's fairly routine. However, once in a while, you have one that jumps out at you as not necessarily being in an appropriate purchase price. And that's what happened recently and is generating this piece of legislation to better protect taxpayers' interests. I'll use the example that came across my desk most recently. During one review, a state entity was proposing to purchase a piece of property for a price significantly higher, $275,000, with $50,000 of that for demolition, than both the estimated market value of $64,000 and the appraised value of $124,000. The higher rate, or the higher rate was due to the fact that the parcel in question was critical to the building project, and the owner knew it and was holding out for the highest price. And other parcels in the same area had been purchased for what I would describe as reasonable prices when we reviewed those purchases, or at least one not long ago. And then all of a sudden, the last piece, the price skyrockets. What has happened since, because I didn't sign off on that purchase as far as making a recommendation, the state agency has gone back to the bargaining table. But it did put in question then the policy that we have had for DNR. And DNR is given the authority to purchase property but can't go above 10% of the appraised value. And so I developed an interest in this whole issue and felt that if that was working for DNR, that other state agencies in the higher ed system, INSCU, should come under the same guidelines. And so that's the purpose of the bill. They would get their appraised value, and if in negotiations for some reason they had to go above, they would have the authority to go above by 10%, but that would be the absolute cap. Now, I should explain, with DNR, we did have one situation that I was involved in a number of years ago, and that was the purchase of the land on Lake Vermilion that was owned by U.S. Steel. And we did have to provide an exemption at that time, but after legislative review for the purchase of the what is now the Vermilion State Park. But there was legislative review and an authorization to go with a higher number. That was a huge tract of land, and a debate as to what the true value of it was. And so we did provide that one-time exemption. So that is the purpose of the bill. It treats all state agencies equally. If this is appropriate for DNR, it should be appropriate for all state agencies, is the main point of the bill. So if there are questions, we can take questions now, or we could go to the amendment. The longer amendment, as I mentioned earlier, Mr. Chairman, is a request by MNSCU. If someone moves that amendment, I would request that it be divided, because I do want to reference the DNR part of the amendment, but the rest of it, because the amendment is broader than MNSCU, it involves Department of Administration and so on, I would prefer to, as it moves between your committee and Ways and Means, have some discussions as to the meaning of that language before it would be adopted.
So let me ask you this, Representative Carlson. On the A3 amendment, that's the one that just basically, it's a delete an or and deletes another short line there.
I think that one would, Mr. Chairman, be all right.
So I'll start by, we'll move that amendment first. I'll move the A3 amendment to be adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I'm reminded that is a little bit more controversial than I had recalled. If we can hold on that amendment.
Okay. I'll ask for questions. Any questions of the testifier? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Carlson. Just want to, two tracks, and if I get the answer I'm looking for, I'll probably dispense with a lot of other questions. If I don't, then I'm going to have a lot more questions. And
tell me what you're looking for, Mr. Chair.
So think carefully how you answer the question, right? Is this as a part of, in addition to, or in lieu of eminent domain?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, this doesn't touch eminent domain at all. That is a tool that a state agency could use. But what's transpired with the piece of property that is in question, or that raised the whole issue, hopefully they're back at the bargaining table and will work out a more reasonable price. They withdrew their offer, the state agency did, to go back to the bargaining table. but this wouldn't modify eminent domain at all. If a state agency wants to use eminent domain, that would be another choice or avenue that they could use, but this doesn't address that.
Representative O'Driscoll, I hope that answered.
Let's get started on it. A few questions have fallen off the table on it. The other part that I have is 10% more than the appraised price. Is that total acquisition cost for the real property as the estate, or is that also inclusive of any relocation and other damages that might be due the individual as a result of the acquisition?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I was looking at it as the cost of the purchase of the property. Maybe there is DNR representation here. They could maybe explain what the history has been relative to DNR in that regard, how that's calculated. Because it is modeled after the DNR legislation, and they're the ones that have the experience with the issue.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Shepherd can help us with some of that experience.
Maybe they could answer that question for you.
We'll invite the person up in the DNR. Mr. Shepherd, if you... Ms. Dyson? While she's getting there, Ms. Dyson, if you want to take a stab at it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, the bill language refers to the appraised value, so I don't think it would include other costs that might be associated with the transaction, but... As Representative Carlson said, DNR has been operating under this law in their statutes for quite a while, so they probably can speak to this more directly.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Susan Damon. I'm the Land Acquisition and Legal Services Manager in the Division of Lands and Minerals of the DNR. First, Mr. Chair, I'd like to state that is correct. This law only pertains to the value of the land or the interest of in the land.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a couple of other clarifying questions. I do want to make sure that we're on record with legislative intent on this. Mm-hmm. So taking the situation that Representative Carlson has brought forward, let's assume that negotiations don't transpire the way that Minsky would like to see them happen. The individual would still, and Minsky still would be interested in acquiring that property. Eminent domain proceedings would still be able to begin, and that may then just shift it from a arm's length transaction negotiation to the hostile eminent domain proceeding.
Representative Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a tool that they have available now. My hope would be, and maybe DNR can answer the question if this law has triggered eminent domain kinds of situations or not. When I met with the state agency about this property, I was encouraging them to go back to the bargaining table and see if they could negotiate a more reasonable price. So that was my goal, and I wasn't pushing them in any particular direction other than this price is too high relative to the history of the property. And by the way, the most recent sale of that property was in 2009 for $1. So there are some probably valid reasons why it might have been transferred for a dollar, but the property, when we looked at the history, it kind of jumps out at you with several questions. But just looking at the appraised value was way out of line in terms of what the other property in the area had gone for and what the appraisals were. Now, if a state agency chooses to use eminent domain outside of this, that would be another question, and maybe DNR could respond.
And Representative Driscoll, you mentioned Minsky, because that was the example that Representative Carlson gave, but my reading of this, it applied to all state agencies, not just Minsky, correct. And I think you understand that. And
Mr. Chair, I'm just using the example that Representative Carlson brought to us to be consistent with that. And that's why I want to be very clear in legislative intent that this in no way takes away an individual's right to eminent domain as well as the state's right to eminent domain. This is a precursor to eminent domain to see if you can negotiate an arm's length transaction.
And Representative Driscoll, that's just with the intent part of it. I just want to make sure that we know
because
that it's not
eminent domain laws and property rights are a very, very big issue. Yep. Evidence of what the legislature and many states across the country have been through in the last 8 to 10 years.
Yep. Ms. Damon, can you take a stab at that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll. Actually, the DNR is subject to a provision in law in 84.0274 that limits the DNR's ability to use eminent domain. The DNR primarily acquires land from willing sellers. We are only authorized to use eminent domain in that provision if the landowner requests that the lands be condemned or if it's specifically authorized by law. So I'm assuming that probably a better agency or entity to answer that question would be MnDOT or MnSQ, which would be more likely to use eminent domain than the DNR.
Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson. With the DNR, we often appropriate dollars to the DNR to do to pass through to third-party purchasers, NGOs, land trusts, conservation groups, and I just want to check my memory here, but if the provision applying to DNR, that also applies to the NGOs that use state funds, is that correct?
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, do you mean the payment for the appraisal, or perhaps you could clarify?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The cap on the 10% and the process for the appraisals that are there.
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, if it comes to the DNR and we pay directly for the land, that applies to us. I would have to go back and check on your specific question regarding the grants, but
Mr. Chair, maybe to be clear. So let's say we appropriate $1 million to the DNR to give to an NGO, a non-government organization, and then they go out and purchase, and they have the property appraised. Do the appraisal requirements, and I don't know if this happens in MnSQ or would happen under. I'm just trying to look at consistency. Would, if we provide state dollars to a state agency and then they give the money to somebody else to buy the property, they negotiate, and then it comes back into the state system. Are the NGO requirements the same if it's state dollars coming from a state agency to them to do the work?
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that is my understanding.
And Mr. Chair, so Representative Carlson, to have this apply to MnSQ and the other agencies, it would be that I don't know if they use NGOs as much as, say, the DNR, but you want to have consistency, correct?
Well, the bill
Representative
is,
Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the bill goes across all of state government. The reason MnSQ is involved was that one instance, but that was just one I'm using as an example as to why I felt we should take a good hard look at the purchase of property and have some sort of a cap. It's my understanding that they follow the same procedures that DNR has. There is a gentleman, I don't have his card before me, that's was here in the audience that maybe can comment on that particular question that you have. But that's what I'm told, that they follow the procedure.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Carlson. I may want to sign it. I like the bill. Kind of in Representative Hansen's train of discussion here, what I understand goes on in the areas of natural resources, whether you're talking about, you know, buying land for protecting water or parks and trails or whatever. There are these other organizations out there. The Minnesota Parks and Trails Council is one of them, and I've had the experience in my district where it kind of goes the other way from Representative Hansen. I was thinking was saying DNR, you know, transfers money to an NGO and they buy the land. I've also seen it where the NGO buys the land, and within I'm looking on, and Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is germane discussion, but on A2, line 1.13, it says a sale price of the real property provided the sale occurred within the past year. And this is the type of articulation, Representative Carlson, that goes on in the DNR area between these NGOs and the agencies. It's almost like a game that it's kind of like holding Jell-O in your hand. It doesn't stay there very long. If you're trying to get your hand around this area in the DNR area, because the Parks and Trails Council buys the land, and with a wink-wink to the DNR, and there's an agreement that the DNR will buy the land then after that, and I think that's where that provision falls in here and why we probably see it in the amendment to allow for that same articulation to happen between NGOs and the government. And so it appears to me that the language on 1.13 on the A2 amendment will allow that to happen with these other agencies too, similar to the way the DNR is working with them. So I'd be curious on your comments about that, but I am interested in the bill as it was originally presented and possibly signing on.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Had the side conversation going while you were talking, so give me just the gist of your question again.
Oh, Representative Carlson, he was talking on the A2 amendment, line 1.13, if somebody buys property, an NGO buys the property to donate to the DNR, that might be problematic with 1.13 of the A2 amendment. My understanding is that if the A2 amendment goes forward, that you only want to incorporate
the first sentence.
The first one, line 1.1 to 1.3, and not incorporate that the second half, 1.14 or 1.4 through the end of the amendment. So, yeah,
and that's pending further discussion, being that that was a brand new amendment.
Does that help answer your question, Representative?
It does, Mr. Chair. And the only thing I would correct there is that in these situations, the NGOs don't donate the land back
or
to
sell
the
it.
The government comes in then and buys it from the NGO with a wink wink between the government and the NGO. Isn't that right, Representative Hansen?
I hear his head rattling, yes. Representative Carlson. Representative Carlson, any further questions? I don't see. Do we want Representative O'Driscoll?
Just to the text of the original bill itself, Subdivision 2, many of the things that are listed in here talk about the qualifications and the conflict of interest and so forth. What we don't talk about is the licensing qualifications of the appraiser. And the reason that I bring that up is if they're licensed through the Minnesota Department of Commerce as appraisers, two different levels, I won't get into that at this point, those individuals will use the USPAP standards, which are the national standards, which already iterate these kinds of things. So I'm wondering if there's a different appraiser in the state of Minnesota that I'm not familiar with who might be enjoined to value these properties.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think the state agencies would have to answer that question. The bill does not address the licensure question at all. Maybe DNR can comment when they're doing it. How does that work?
Yeah. Ms. Damon.
With licensure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, we do use licensed appraisers who conform to the USPAP standards.
Representative Druskowski. Or excuse me, O'Driscoll, you finish follow up.
Again, I'm just wondering if the language should be crafted then to subscribe to the USPAP standards as those change and are updated by statute, that it's more consistent, so we wouldn't have to be back in a revision on this, because, again, many of the things that are in here and a whole lot more that aren't in here are part of the USPAP standards. So when you start articulating some of the steps but not all of them, it may draw a question. And as we heard, DNR uses, and we're using them kind of as the standard on this, the USPAP standards and Minnesota licensed appraisers. So,
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to get maybe some clarity from the author. Why we're taking out the part about the interest in real property. And then the second question, Representative Carlson, is maybe a technical one. I heard Ms. Damon talk about the fact that DNR's already got, is it rules or do we have law that gives you that 10% reality in your agency. And then the question related to that is, should this language all be in one spot in statute rather than two different places?
Representative Carlson, Ms. Damon? Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we actually, the DNR is actually subject to the provisions in Minnesota Statute Section 84.0272, which provides for a procedure in acquiring land. That contains nearly identical language to the language in House File 2093, but it also contains additional paragraphs that allow us to value stream easements by formula, and there's also a provision that allows us to do minimum value acquisitions for low-value property. We also have provisions that pertain to the native prairie bank easements and to the ACUB, the Army-compatible use buffer easements around Camp Ripley, and those we can pay by formula that is established in law. And those enable us to acquire land without having to pay for an appraisal.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
If I could just thank you. Representative Carlson, the interest in real property, is there a reason why you pulled out that on line 1.10 and 1.11 on the original bill? Do we know why we did that?
Representative Carlson. Yeah,
it would take easements out is what I'm told by DNR.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Carlson, you might have been earlier when you said there was somebody here, I think it might have been Mr. Jashke with Bowser. I don't know if he had some comment or you've got something with Bowser.
If
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that would be fine. He has some... And this kind of goes to the core of your 24-hour rule. When we adopt, if the committee is willing, that first section with the amendment, he would like to have Bowser included. And I just talked to him before the meeting. And I don't know if your 24-hour rule, if an oral amendment like that would be appropriate or not, but he may want to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Carlson. And with the being this is our first committee meeting this year and getting everybody getting back on the swing, we're going to allow the amendment to go forward today and waive the 24-hour rule because it's the first day of session. That's our first meeting.
This was
actually filed. I understand this was filed before that. But not the Bowser piece, yeah. I see the gentleman coming to the front here, and please state your name for your
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. John Jasky, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources, and actually the same statements Ms. Damon made about the DNR statutes apply to the Board of Water and Soil Resources statutes, too, regarding acquisition of conservation easements. There's a separate section of law in a couple of places, specifically in Section 103F that outlines the procedures, maximum payment rates, and so forth, and those conservation easements never get to anywhere close to the above 10% because we are capped at a 90% of fair market values. But the issue is simply how the procedures in this proposed legislation would have to be or it wouldn't have to be accommodated while we went through those 103F procedures. So we'd like to see the same provision added to include the Board of Water and Soil Resources in Representative Carlson's proposed amendment.
So, Representative Carlson, what do you want to do with the what's your pleasure with the amendments?
If you move, Mr. Chairman, or somebody in the committee, the A2 amendment, then I would request the person that moved the amendment divide the amendment because what I would like to include would be page 1, line 9, where it says before the period insert but does not include the Department of Natural Resources. The intent was not to change any of the statutes with Department of Natural Resources. As I was saying earlier, use them as an example of what's currently being done. And what we were just talking about as far as the Board of Water and Soil Resources, they would like language that would add them to that sentence, so then it would just be Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Water and Soil Resources was the proposed language. So that would be the oral change if someone would be willing to divide it and move that.
So members, I'll move the lines 1.1 to 1.3 of the A2 amendment, not the rest of it, and add after natural resources on 1.3 the line or the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And this was given to me by Mr. Shepherd. Excuse me, Ms. Dyson. Any questions of the amendment? That Representative Carlson, does that get at the gist of what you?
Yes.
All in favor of the A2 amendment as stated, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's adopted. And
the
Mr.
I would prefer the other amendments not then be offered, or that other amendment.
Okay. So members, any more questions of the testifiers? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2093 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The motion's adopted.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Chair Carlson.
Thank you.
Representative Mariani. And I'll make a motion that House File 1631 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members. And Mr. Chair, we should have a DE1 amendment.
I see the DE1 amendment. Is that the way you like to have the bill brought?
Yeah, I think, yes, Mr. Chair. I would still request a small oral change to that, but this makes sure that we meet the 20-year committee rule for...
Representative Mariani, what is your small oral amendment to the DE1 amendment?
Mr. Chair...
we'll just incorporate it.
On line 1.5, we have the phrase, rapidly growing demographic group. And frankly, as I thought about it, we're putting something in statute, and maybe 50 years from now, this group may not be rapidly growing. And so I wanted to make sure that we had language that is contextual. So I would say to strike the words after Latinos on line 1.5, strike the words are a rapidly growing. And then insert constitute a major. So the language would read Latinos constitute a major demographic group in the state.
Does everybody have that? Modification of the amendment. So I'll move the amendment as modified. The DE1 amendment as modified. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment passes. Amendment's adopted. Please describe your bill then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I will be very brief. I've got several folks who are going to offer testimony, and I think it's more important that you hear from them. I've been in legislature for a dozen years. For 8 of those years, I was the only member of the legislature of who's Latino, of Latino heritage. I'm now joined by two others. Unfortunately, they're in the Senate. So we need more Latinos in the dominant.
We don't recognize that body in this group.
Exactly. the interesting thing is that during that period of time is also a period of time where we've seen incredible growth of the Latino community, which is projected to continue to grow. And during that period of time, Latino community also became the largest racial ethnic community in the nation, surpassing our African-American community in that category. Latinos have a long, long history with this state. One of my constituents is an 80-plus-year-old gentleman who owns a small business over the High Bridge on the west side. And he would regale me of stories of growing up and working in the beats, Betabel, up in the Red River Valley with his family and his ancestors working up there and being a critically important part of that industry in our state. And that's really reflective of the history of Latinos, primarily Mexicanos, but not exclusively Latinos, their significance to the well-being of the state economically as well as socially. You would probably be hard-pressed to find a county in the state right now where we don't have significant numbers of people of Latino heritage who reside and are part of those communities. And so this bill basically, as other bills that we've done over the years, sets aside a day. It's not a holiday, so we're not talking about incurring any kind of mandates or unfunded liabilities for the state, but sets aside a day of recognition of a true American hero who is of a significant presence in the Latino community, and that's Cesar Chavez. And so basically, Mr. Chair, members, this sets aside March 31st as a day dedicated that our state says we'll dedicate to recognize and acknowledge Cesar Chavez, but actually really it's about recognizing and acknowledging the currently tens of thousands, and Mr. Garcia can tell us more accurately what that figure is, of Minnesota citizens and residents of Latino heritage. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'm going to ask Mr. Hector Garcia from the Chicano Latino Affairs Council to share some thoughts, and then I'd like to, after that, invite some other people down to share some thoughts with you as well.
We can be quick. We're running short on time here. Welcome to our committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Hector Garcia, Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, one of four ethnic state councils. And thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the committee, for this opportunity to talk with you about Cesar Chavez, who has been called the Martin Luther King of Latino civil rights. He was born in 1927 and raised in farms in the Southwest. He was a prominent labor leader and civil rights activist, serving as a voice and community organizer for California migrant workers. A Mexican-American, he sought to reform discrimination and co-founded the United Farm Workers, America's only agricultural union. And President Obama posthumously gave his wife, Helen, the Presidential Medal of Freedom for her husband's years of nonviolent activism on behalf of workers' rights. Dr. Martin Luther King sent him a letter that read, "Our separate struggles are really one, a struggle for freedom, for dignity, and for humanity. My colleagues and I commend you for your bravery and salute you for your indefatigable work against poverty and injustice." As Representative Mariani just mentioned, the Latino community is growing very rapidly. Between 2000 and 2010, we grew by 75%, while the European American community grew by 1.6%. And we are currently about 300,000 Latinos in the state of Minnesota. You're all very familiar with the disparities that afflict our community and how much of an impact it is already having on the state as a whole. And in the future, with the demographic growth, will continue to have a serious impact. And so I think it is imperative that particularly our youth be inspired with role models and heroes such as Cesar Chavez. Open societies operate successfully by inspiring their citizens rather than by commanding them to excel and innovate. And so I see this as a great opportunity for you to plant in the spirit of Latinos the can-do attitude for which the U.S. is known. Cesar Chavez said multiple times, si se puede, yes we can. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and have the two gentlemen with you state their name for the tape.
Good morning. My name is Ramona Reguin de Rosales, and I'm the founder and executive director of Academia Cesar Chavez Charter School in St. Paul.
My name is Joseph Tawa, and I'm in sixth grade and part of the student council at Academia Cesar Chavez.
My name is Kevin Gutierrez, and I am in sixth grade and also part of the student council at Academia Cesar Chavez.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I believe that this bill should be passed because Cesar Chavez was a leader who happened to be Latino. Not only was he a leader for Latinos, but he was a leader for all peoples. He was a civil rights leader, farm labor leader, community organizer. He was a true American hero. I had the honor to have been personally mentored and trained by Cesar Chavez in the late 1960s here in Minnesota. During this time, I organized some of the first great boycotts in Minnesota. I was also a part of the committee that was formed to rename a portion of Concord Street to Cesar Chavez Street in St. Paul's West Side. Let me tell you a little bit about Cesar Chavez. Cesar Chavez was a loving and humble man who believed in peace and nonviolent way of life. He was an educated man who stayed up late at night to read. In the 1960s, he helped me to visualize a dream that I would someday develop a school that would help our children to succeed. Cesar Chavez wanted our children to learn the important values of respect, hard work, and he wanted to see them become great citizens and leaders and contributing members of society. To honor his life's work at Academia Cesar Chavez, we are teaching our students the values of hard work, family, unity, and respect. This is why I built and named in honor of him a school named Cesar Chavez. Lastly, it would only be right for the state of Minnesota to recognize the contributions of Cesar Chavez, because farming has been part of Minnesota's history, and Cesar Chavez was a man looking out for the well-being of farm laborers. We want his legacy to live on. I have today here, as the students introduce themselves, are two sixth grade students, and they would like to recite for you a Cesar Chavez pledge, a pledge our students recite daily in both Spanish and English.
Yes, I can. In this beautiful and great world, I am unique. I am very special and full of love. I am intelligent. I can reach my goals by being a good student and by always doing my work with love, with pride, and with pleasure. Yes, I can.
Sí se puede. En este mundo tan, tan lindo y tan grande, yo soy único, yo soy especial, lleno de amor y de inteligencia. Yo puedo realizar mis sueños siendo un buen estudiante y haciendo siempre mi trabajo. Con amor, con orgullo y con gusto, porque sé que sí se puede.
Sí se puede. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, members, any questions? Representative Pepin?
Mr. Chair, I just have a question for Representative Mariani.
Ask your question.
Thank you. Representative Mariani, I noticed in the sheet that was handed out by the Chicano Latino Council that there are eight states where the Cesar Chavez Day is recognized as a holiday with schools closing and state offices closing, and I know that this bill does not do that, and I'm just curious if that's the next step, if your intention is in a year or two to make it a holiday where schools and offices are closing.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I have no such intentions, although I can't speak for the wisdom of future legislatures in terms of what they want to do. We can have that debate at that point. But at this point, the bill before you is catches the full intent of my intention.
Representative Pep.
Thank you. I'm always a little worried with schools closing, you know, a dozen days during the winter. I'm starting to wonder if kids are going to be able to even go to school.
Mr. Chair, I think we've lost 5 or 6 days already this year.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House Files 1631 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And referred to the committee. And members, just a note here, we're going to have a lot of bills this session that are going to come before us. I joked with somebody the other day that we're going to go into session at 10 this morning and be meeting continuously through till the midnight on the night of deadlines. But it's a little overstatement, but we've got a lot of bills that are going to come to us with all the stuff that the governor's proposing. And last year we had a large number of bills come for us. So if stuff's on the schedule for the day, it may be progress, and it may not get out of the committee. It may be progress till the next committee day. And we may not get through everything that comes to us. So just be aware, we're going to want to get our work done here in committee, and we're probably going to have a few extra meetings, evening meetings, to get all our work done. So be prepared for that, people. And with that, we're adjourned. Okay.